From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! We all know the Civil War from Scarlett O'Hara's perspective and Gone with the Wind. What about the slaves' perspective? We'll speak with author Alice Randall. But first, with Slobodan Milosevic's extradition to The Hague, we'll have a debate on whether the former Yugoslav leader should be prosecuted for war crimes.
I consider this tribunal false tribunal.
All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. authorities agreed today to hand an American serviceman accused of rape over to Japanese authorities. Sergeant Timothy Woodland is suspected in the rape of a local woman in her 20s last week in a popular tourist area on the southern island of Okinawa, where 26,000 U.S. troops are stationed. Woodland has denied the allegations, and the U.S. government had refused to hand him over to Japanese custody until it receives assurances that his rights would be protected. Washington's hesitation in approving Woodland's handover had generated anger in Okinawa and renewed criticism of the special legal status granted to U.S. troops stationed there. Meanwhile, in Washington, police yesterday questioned the wife of California Congressman Gary Condit as they continue their investigation into the disappearance of Chandra Levy, a former intern in Washington. Levy disappeared May 1st and is yet to be found. Condit has said that the two were good friends, but Levy's family and friends have said they believe the two were romantically involved. Their suspicions have been buttressed by the allegations from a flight attendant, Anne Marie Smith, who claims that she and Condit had a 10-month affair. Authorities are looking into allegations by Smith's lawyer that Condit tried to pressure her to sign a false affidavit claiming they'd never had an affair. Chandra Levy remains missing. This news from Moscow. Most of the top management of Russia's most prominent independent radio station resigned yesterday after a court decision put the broadcaster under the authority of the government-controlled gas company. The station, Echo of Moscow, was part of the embattled Media Most and stood in recent weeks as one of the last outposts of media freedom in Russia. In a series of moves that critics said were aimed at stifling the independent media, other Media Most properties, including MTV television network, this year came under control of the natural gas monopoly Gazprom. The Russian government holds a majority of seats on the Gazprom board. This news from Chile. The judge who indicted General Augusto Pinochet wants to question former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger about the assassination of a U.S. filmmaker in Chile during the former dictator's rule. Judge Juan Guzman has prepared more than 50 questions to be posed to Kissinger about the killing of Charles Horman shortly after the 1973 coup led by Pinochet. The Supreme Court must approve the questions before they're sent to Kissinger through the Foreign Ministry and the State Department. Approval is considered certain. Charles Horman was arrested September 17, 1973, 6 days after the bloody coup in which Pinochet toppled President Salvador Allende. Horman was taken to the main Santiago soccer stadium, which was used as a detention camp, where he was killed. President Bush has named San Francisco's top federal prosecutor to head the embattled FBI, tossing a bureau outsider into one of the hottest seats in Washington. If confirmed, Robert Mueller will inherit an insular agency that's facing three investigations and has been embarrassed by a string of recent controversies, from the mishandling of documents in the Oklahoma City bombing case that prompted a delay in the execution of Timothy McVeigh, to the arrest of accused spy Robert Hansen, a top-ranking FBI counterintelligence operative. Mueller is the U.S. attorney in San Francisco, and he worked in the Justice Department in the first Bush administration. He's also a Vietnam War veteran. He has the support of leaders from both political parties, and Attorney General John Ashcroft has praised the nomination. A man who served 14 years in prison for rape and murder was freed after DNA tests showed blood found on his shirt did not come from the victim in the attack. Calvin Washington was released on $5,000 bail Thursday based on the test performed on a shirt that had been seized from a house where Washington was staying at the time of the crime. And this news from Portland, Oregon. A jury awarded a fired flight attendant $400,000 from the drug testing laboratory that incorrectly determined she had cheated on a drug test. Yasuko Ishikawa was fired by Delta Airlines in 1999 after a routine drug test showed tampering. A separate test showed no drugs were present. Federal law requires that millions of transportation workers be tested each year in the name of public safety. Last year, a review by the Department of Health and Human Services found some labs had not followed government standards in conducting the validity tests. New fears about the online security of private information were stirred yesterday when Eli Lilly and Company said it had inadvertently released over the internet the email addresses of more than 600 people on Prozac. Hundreds of patients had signed up at a Lilly website for an automated email reminding them to take their dose of the antidepressant. A Lilly spokesperson said a message sent announcing the end of the service mistakenly included the email addresses of all the subscribers in the message header. The Indiana affiliate of the American Civil Liberties Union has asked the Federal Trade Commission to investigate. It accused the Indianapolis-based pharmaceutical giant of violating its own internet privacy policy.
He didn't get up, he just prayed. He said, the old master come and support me. He quit praying and then asked the Lord, have mercy on the old master. Lord, have mercy on the old master. Lord, have mercy on the old master. He said, old master, whooping with a bull whoop. His husband, have mercy on the old master. And said, old master, whooped him and he kept him, wouldn't get up, you know, just flinch, you know, just like a person, you know, and putting hits, you know, the flinch. He just prayed for old master. The old master stepped back and said, I'm ready mind to kick you naked. I'm ready mind to kick you naked. Nigga never stopped praying. You know, he had go on leaving praying. Go on leaving praying. Because he wouldn't stop. Well, that was through the Lord, you know, that's caused that.
A former slave describing her experience. Later in the program, we'll speak with Alice Randall, an African-American author who has put out a kind of sequel to Gone with the Wind called The Wind on Gone, but this one from the perspective of a former slave. But first, emboldened by the handover of Slobodan Milosevic, the chief UN prosecutor yesterday demanded the immediate surrender of wartime Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic and his top military officer. They're accused of genocide against Bosnian Muslims and have been at large for the past 6 years. Prosecutor Carlo Del Ponte accused Bosnian Serb soldiers of protecting the fugitives. And in a decision that could reverberate in future trials, war crimes tribunal judges made it easier to convict war crime suspects of genocide, saying their actions did not necessarily have to be part of a master plan or campaign to eliminate an entire community. The ruling comes just days after Serbian authorities handed over the former Yugoslav president, Slobodan Milosevic, to The Hague. Milosevic is the first former head of state to face the UN War Crimes Tribunal. The handover dramatically increases the authority of the international body. Some are concerned that the tribunal, which is heavily influenced by Western nations, is becoming too powerful. Milosevic appeared before the court on Tuesday and refused to enter a plea to the charges against him, dismissing the court as an illegal organ.
I consider this tribunal false tribunal and indictments false indictments. It is illegal being not appointed by UN General Assembly, so I have no need to appoint counsel to illegal organ.
That was Slobodan Milosevic addressing The Hague. He also said his trial was aimed at producing false justification for the war crimes of NATO, a reference to the bombing of Kosovo and Serbia in 1999. We're going to first go to Richard Dicker, who is director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch. He's just flown in from The Hague. Can you describe the scene in The Hague when Milosevic was brought before the court?
Well, I think from an international justice perspective, it was a remarkable scene to see an individual who just a few short months before had been the near absolute ruler of Yugoslavia and a man accused of crimes against humanity and war crimes as a head of state sitting in the dock as a defendant before an international tribunal with a Moroccan judge, a Jamaican judge, and a British judge. It was a demonstration, I believe, of the growing strength of international justice.
Ramsey Clark also joins us on the phone, and he's just recently returned from Belgrade. He has offered to help Slobodan Milosevic in his defense. Ramsey Clark is the former Attorney General of the United States. Your response to the, well, extradition of Slobodan Milosevic to The Hague?
The International Criminal Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia is an illegitimate court for too many reasons to describe, but first, the UN Charter did not obtain the power to create an international criminal tribunal. There would never have been a UN had there been within the Charter power to create such a court. The only ways to create the court are by amending the Charter or by international treaty, multinational treaty, which has now been done, and we have, I think, about 36 out of the 60 required ratifications from the 120 countries who signed the treaty. So you have an illegitimate court. You have a surrender in violation of the statute of that court, which requires that there be compliance with domestic law. And of course, there was not compliance with the laws of Yugoslavia because, at least by their words, they prohibit the extradition or surrender of a citizen of those countries. Some countries have had to amend their laws or even constitutions in order to comply with the international statute so that they can, through domestic law, release somebody. And, of course, you had a surrender at a time when the case was before the Constitutional Court of Yugoslavia, and that court's power was preempted. So it was an illegitimate court that was created by the United States to persecute enemies, the first one of all the countries in the world, of all the members of the United Nations. We single out one. It can't do equal justice. Justice depends on equality. Equality is the mother of justice. But here you've got the United States, which brutally assaulted Yugoslavia for 79 days of bombing. It can't be held accountable. Only Yugoslavia, the victim. And yet the United States finances the court. Our ambassador to international courts has conceded that we're the principal sponsor, principal finance.
Well, let me get response from Richard Dicker of Human Rights Watch.
Yeah, I appreciate Attorney General Clark's comments, of course, but I think he's quite wrong on a number of points of law and fact. First of all, the court was created according to the Charter of the United Nations, which gives in Chapter 7 of the UN Charter the UN Security Council the authority to deal with threats to international peace and security. I'm curious if the Attorney General here does not regard the massive killings that took place in Bosnia and Croatia in the early 90s as not a threat to international peace and security. More interestingly is Slobodan Milosevic's own recognition of the legitimacy of the court that Attorney General Clark seems to find illegal because Slobodan Milosevic signed the 1995 peace accords, which obligated Yugoslavia, on whose behalf Slobodan Milosevic signed, to cooperate with the court. So I think on that point it's quite wide of the mark. I also think that the surrender issue is an interesting one, and certainly reasonable people can disagree on it, but I think the point is that Yugoslavia, as every other state, and this was true of Croatia, true of Bosnia, had an overriding obligation under international law that was its membership in the United Nations and the Security Council resolution to cooperate with the tribunal. Those international law obligations transcended domestic legislation or decrees. The point being, regardless of what law existed on the books in Belgrade, there was an obligation to cooperate with that court. Lastly, the Serbian prime minister, when he decided to circumvent the process, and I agree, there was a circumvention of the constitutional court process in Yugoslavia, but he did so on the basis of a provision that Milosevic inserted into the constitution of Serbia, Article 135, which gave the Serbian Republic the ability to ignore dictates from the Federal Republic in instances of national importance. So the NATO campaign against Yugoslavia is a cause of concern. There were violations of international humanitarian law committed that Human Rights Watch looked into, but I'm curious to hear Attorney General Clark not make one reference to the forced expulsion of 800,000 Albanians from Kosovo, the killings of several thousand and mass rapes that happened at the hands of Milosevic's paramilitaries.
Ramsey Clark.
Let me go back to the to the Charter for a moment. The Article 7 of the Charter, which is the war powers of the Security Council, simply says nothing about courts, and the idea that a court is a proper instrumentality for preventing violence is turns the situation around. Obviously, a court can't act until after something has happened. You can't mention Croatia and Bosnia in connection with this because he's not charged with that. He's charged, at least at this time, at the time he was arrested, only with what happened in Kosovo. The expulsion of hundreds of thousands of Kosovars occurred when the United States started bombing, and our bombing killed thousands of them. It destroyed Pristina. Anyone who watched TV, even if they weren't there, as I was, saw that the U.S. bombing was destroying Pristina, which is the capital of Kosovo. The nation of Serbia was being attacked by foreign aggression. Ordinarily, I mean, the country was bombed from one end to the other. There have been over 200,000 Serbs expelled during the U.N. watch in Kosovo, from Kosovo. We haven't heard any complaints about that. During the bombing of Serbia, I saw major apartment housing developments bombed, schools bombed, churches bombed, industry wiped out, power, water, agriculture, infrastructure from one end to the other of the country destroyed. You had things like Serbian radio TV bombed and 12 fine journalists killed, the Chinese embassy, the Greek consulate in Nice. We bombed that country from one end to the other. We were trying to dismantle. We've been dismantling Yugoslavia since 1991. And the country was trying to defend its sovereignty and protect the lives of its people. There was a war going on. War is hell, if you don't believe it. Ask Senator Kerry. These things are not easy. Milosevic himself was never in Kosovo. The people who are in Kosovo haven't even been charged, the Serbian troops. Kosovars haven't been charged, won't be charged. There are deaths in Kosovo every day now, almost, of Serbs, and 100,000 left in Kosovo are threatened. You've got Albanian and Kosovo people fighting in Macedonia, and the United States tilts their way. But the worst part is it corrupted the UN. The Charter does not authorize it. The UN can do anything if it can create a court like this. Why did we go to the lengths of years of struggle to create an international criminal tribunal, which I've always supported, by treaty, which is legitimate, which can cover the whole world, which can charge superpowers as well as small powers that we seek to destroy, governments we seek to change? Why do we let a superpower target enemies, Hutus and Serbs, which is the antithesis of justice? Through the Security Council is because the United States has the power, and the United States does it, and it corrupts justice.
Richard Dicker, I know you have to leave, and we're going to be joined in a minute by Ruth Wedgwood of Yale University, but a final comment to Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
Again, Attorney General Clark makes a number of interesting and certainly important points, but leaves out a great deal in terms of important facts. I will, of course, make a point of sending to Attorney General Clark the report that we did identifying the violations of international humanitarian law, that is, the laws of war, that were committed in the course of the NATO bombing campaign, and in particular, an indiscriminate use of force directed against some of the sites that Attorney General Clark just mentioned, and a number of deaths of civilians that was four times higher than the Pentagon reported, but probably a third of the 2,000 figure the Yugoslav authorities reported. But there were serious violations committed by the NATO forces. The issue here isn't to whitewash what NATO did. The issue here, from a human rights perspective, not a political perspective, is to identify the violations of the Genocide Convention, the Geneva Conventions, the Convention Against Torture, that occurred on all sides, regardless of their politics or their nationality. And in that context, again, what Attorney General Clark doesn't seem to speak to is the deaths that took place, for example, in the village of Racak in January of 1999, when Serbian paramilitaries moved in and assassinated 45 civilians, tortured and executed many more. There was a widespread pattern in the context of an internal armed conflict between the Kosovar Albanians, represented by the KLA at the time, and the Yugoslav armed forces. No side should be allowed to commit violations of the laws of war, and perhaps Slobodan Milosevic's indictment is the start of what will be bringing justice to violations committed by all sides in Kosovo. Lastly, I can tell you, having been involved for 5 years in an effort to establish the permanent International Criminal Court that Attorney General Clark refers to, it would have been impossible to create a treaty-based court in a short period of time in order to have jurisdiction and bring justice to the victims of crimes across Yugoslavia and Kosovo. He's quite right. This is a treaty-based court. It will come into force in next year. Unfortunately, the United States has put itself on the wrong side of the debate in that court, regarding that court. Hopefully that will change. But all of this is part of a movement towards international justice, and whether it's the former General Rios Montt of Guatemala or Slobodan Milosevic or Ariel Sharon, the sense of impunity for leaders who commit these crimes is ending. We've got to look beyond the politics of the individuals and see that justice is done.
Richard Dicker, do you think we'll see Ariel Sharon before The Hague?
Well, not The Hague. No. I'm quite certain we won't, but Human Rights Watch has called for an investigation into the events that occurred in Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in September 1982,
well,
a criminal investigation.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, and I know you have to go. Richard Dicker has just flown back from The Hague, where Slobodan Milosevic was extradited and will be tried before a Hague tribunal, director of International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch. Attorney General, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, has just returned from Belgrade and has offered to help Slobodan Milosevic in his defense. We're going to remain with Ramsey Clark when we come back, and we'll be joined by Ruth Wedgwood, professor of international law at Yale. Then we'll be speaking to Alice Randall, who's written a kind of segue to Gone with the Wind from quite a different perspective, the perspective of a slave. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue on the extradition of Slobodan Milosevic to The Hague, two Canadian lawyers are traveling to the International War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague at the request of the former Yugoslav president. They're part of an international support committee that considers Milosevic a political prisoner. It was formed in Berlin in March. The International Committee to Defend Slobodan Milosevic is made up of 200 lawyers, writers, and intellectuals. We're joined on the telephone by former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who just returned from Belgrade, and Ruth Wedgwood, Professor of International Law at Yale, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, who served as an independent expert for the tribunal in the case of a Croatian general. Ramsey Clark, your response to Richard Dicker before the break.
You know, to me, it's very sad to see the human rights community politicized so that can't see that this tribunal for former Yugoslavia, as the one for Rwanda, is purely political. We went for 50 years. We saw terrible slaughters all over the world. I mean, just there was no consideration of a tribunal for Vietnam. There was none for Cambodia or Kampuchea. All the tragedies of those periods. And out of expediency, when we finally had control of the Security Council, we did something that the UN Charter never permitted, never authorized, and the five permanent members would never have joined the United Nations because they'd just come out of World War II and they didn't want to be charged for Hiroshima or Dresden or any of the other mass killings that happened in civilians that happened during World War II. These tribunals probably and very hopefully be the last of the ad hoc tribunals, because you can't have a tribunal that focuses only on one time, one place, one people, and call it equal justice. But one of the things the human rights community and our friend from Human Rights Watch just did, you don't need a trial when you've already convicted somebody in your mind. And the demonization that's gone for it here, we've got the Beast of the Balkans and his wife is the Red Witch, and we attribute everything that's happened to him, and we act as if we know exactly his responsibility, and we put him before a tribunal that already tells you what it's about, the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia, no other country.
Well, let's get the response of Ruth Wedgwood.
Well, I guess I'm kind of puzzled by Mr. Clark's view. Under the UN Charter, which, rather like the U.S. Constitution, has had interpretations that evolve over time, and I don't think any of us object to the fact that the Constitution has grown. But under the UN Charter, the Council, Security Council, on which China and Russia sit with vetoes, has had explicit textual power to create subsidiary organs. And in the middle of the Bosnian War in 1993, when there was a hope of stopping the ongoing ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, there was literally no other way to do this. Cyrus Vance, who was a very thoughtful man, I think came around to the view that one had to have this kind of tribunal because otherwise there was no hope of deterring the ongoing tactics that were used by Republika Srpska, the Bosnian Serb Republic, with the backing and indeed at the instigation of Milosevic. So to retrospectively wish there had been a different way, well, I wish there hadn't been a war, and there's plenty of, I think, textual foundation for it. One time, one place, one people, well, in fact, the kind of workload any of these tribunals has is so overwhelming. I know that there's a hope that a permanent court would be able to do all conflicts all over the world. In practice, this one-time, one-place tribunal has had its hands full, even keeping up with the cases it does have. So there is a limit to what one institution can do. It's not one people. They have tried cases concerning Croatians, concerning Muslims and Bosniaks, as well as Serbs. And indeed, the purpose of the tribunal was to try to show each community that it had a stake in enforcing international standards of humanitarian law.
Ramsey Clark.
It's easy to talk about textual, but what we've really done is given an open end to the United States while it controlled the Security Council to do whatever it wanted to, or the Security Council to do whatever it wanted to. And the idea that the creation of this court had anything to do with the cessation of hostilities in Bosnia is at best extremely naive. If all they had done is create this tribunal, does anyone really believe that anything would have stopped in Bosnia? Absolutely not. It was jet strikes by U.S. aircraft help bring that thing to an end, and we ought to remember that I've known Cy Vance for years, but if you look at the Vance Owen plan, it made Bosnia look like a checkerboard. What we've permitted is powerful foreign interests to dismantle Yugoslavia and balkanize it in ways that had never been dreamed of. And when we talk about the ethnic cleansing and all, you've got 400,000 Serbs swept out of Krajina, where they lived for hundreds of years. You've got 200,000 swept. You've totally segregated the community, and you've got the potential and constant outbursts of violence in most parts. The idea of Yugoslavia was a very important idea for peace in the Balkans, and it's been undermined, and the individual countries, with a few exceptions, perhaps like Slovenia, are not really economically viable. 90% of their trade was internal, and U.S. pressures have done this. That's what it's been about. And we want and are crippling Serbia further right now. It's to see it bribed with a $1.3 billion demand that they surrender somebody before last Friday, or they're going to lose aid. You've destroyed at least $20 billion worth of property there, and if you add to the loss of income and productivity during the years, it goes way beyond that. It's the pure use of force and power by the United States to have its way in the region.
Ramsey Clark, do you think Slobodan Milosevic is guilty of any crimes?
I don't go around judging people. What I think is that as the head of nation that was under attack, he had a duty to defend its sovereignty. And that's basically what he was trying to do. And he had a duty to protect the lives of its citizens, all of its citizens. And there was, in addition to foreign aggression, which can hardly be denied, there was internal insurrection that was fomented in part, large part, although it had a natural base. The KLA is only one illustration of it. It was not an easy situation. But I don't know of any evidence, and I haven't seen any evidence, that he was directing the military in any of the major, or any of the minor for that matter, but the major ones are the only ones we really know about.
Well, let me
violations
ask.
That have been carried in the press. You just carry one side in the press. You very rarely hear about the KLA. We've condoned continuing assaults by KLA, both in Kosovo against Serbs and in Macedonia.
Ruth Wedgwood, what do you think are the most important charges against Slobodan Milosevic?
Well, in this particular indictment, I think there's a CNN effect of a different kind than we're used to talking about. We talk about CNN when it comes to when we intervene. But here, there's no way that Slobodan Milosevic can claim that he was ignorant of what was going on in the war in the South, because it was on television every day of folks being forced over the border in tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, nanas and grandpas and infants, and a lot of death from exposure. And Milosevic, who is the was the chairman of the Supreme Defense Council of Yugoslavia, was the commander of Yugoslav forces and de facto commander of the paramilitary and police forces. There's no way he can claim ignorance of this. And one of the grand principles from Nuremberg is that if you fail to, even if all you do is fail to control your troops when they're running amok, you are responsible for their behavior. So if Attorney General Clark is interested in law and equality and regularity, that's an interest that bears witness in this case. And as for what ended the Bosnian War, indeed, it was in part jet strikes, but I take it that Attorney General Clark doesn't like those either. They're on powerful foreign interests. Business at the moment is not interested anyway, anyhow, in the Balkans. Believe me, I run roundtables to try to talk about Balkan issues in New York, and only a very few business people show up. This is not some conspiracy of capitalism. It's a very poor region with very small markets. It's torn itself apart. And one, while it's a complicated story, the Serb nationalism of the kind that was virulently fomented by Karadzic and Milosevic both is in large part responsible for what happened. And as for how Milosevic was produced to the tribunal, that will be litigated in front of the court. There's at least one precedent that's on more or less on point of the Dokmanovic case. But it is true that Djindjic, who is a Serbian politician, the prime minister of Serbia, claimed that he had constitutional power to do what he did. And I'm not a Yugoslav lawyer. I can't gainsay him. It is true that Serbia and Yugoslavia had a duty under the rules of the tribunal to produce the defendant, ultimately. And finally, just in terms of the NATO air campaign, NATO, to be sure, was never designed in its order of battle or order of intervention for this kind of operation. So they were adapting as best they could to a very different kind of conflict. But I do wonder how one would otherwise have stopped the opening of the spring offensive by the Serb troops in Kosovo. And I am the first to decry reverse ethnic cleansing. I think it's a pity that the Serbs have been, in turn, harassed by their Albanian neighbors. But when you have official forces of the Yugoslav government undertaking this campaign, second year running, with Milosevic flunking what, to my mind, is the three-bite rule. You know, he did Vukovar, he did Bosnia, and now he's about to do Kosovo. The idea that you would tolerate it yet a third time is incredible to me.
Ramsey Clark, final comment.
As to his watching what happened on TV and therefore knowing what happened, it's interesting that the United States felt it had to destroy the Syrian radio television office building. Had interviews several times in there during the bombing, and they killed 12 journalists. Of course, he knew what was going on. He knew, too, that the United States, and I don't know why we keep calling it NATO, because virtually all the aircraft and will was the United States, was bombing the daylights out of Kosovo. In addition, there were KLA troops.
We have 30
making
seconds.
Attacks all over the country. It was a chaotic situation. You can lay down and die, or you can defend your country as you see it. And it wasn't an easy choice to make. But I wouldn't assume his guilt any more than you won't assume that his arrest was legal. You say that'll be decided in the court. We can let the facts of the case be decided in the court. But the
Ramsey
court
Clark,
itself is illegal.
Will you be part of the defense team?
I don't believe so. I want to help, and I'll do what's possible. But right now, as you know, he said he does not want a defense team, and it remains to be seen what happens.
Well, I thank you both for being with us. Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark under Lyndon Johnson has just returned from Belgrade, and Ruth Wedgwood, Professor of International Law at Yale, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and independent expert for the U.N. Tribunal at The Hague. You are listening to Democracy Now! In our last segment, we're going to take a look at the book that has shaped people's view of the Civil War, perhaps more than any other. And I'm sure you're familiar with the major characters.
Red, you go. Where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
When we come back, we'll be joined by someone who does give a damn, the author of a new book, a kind of sequel to Gone with the Wind, but it's told from a slave's perspective. Alice Randall will be joining us. Stay with us.
Thank you.
You are listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Yes, for much of the world, the fictional characters Scarlett O'Hara and Rhett Butler from Gone with the Wind are real figures in the history of the Civil War. Margaret Mitchell's book has made a deep imprint on American society. Gone with the Wind has been translated into 37 languages with more than 25 million copies in print. It won the Pulitzer Prize in 1936, the year after its publication, and was made into one of the most popular movies of all time. But it's a South without miscegenation, without whippings, without families sold apart, without blacks striving for their education. Gone with the Wind depicts a South that never existed. These are the words of Alice Randall, an African-American writer who's decided to set the record straight. The result is The Wind Done Gone, a new book that's just out. Wind Done Gone picks up at the end of the Civil War, where Gone with the Wind leaves off, but instead tells the story from the perspective of Scarlett O'Hara's half-sister, Sanara, who was born into slavery and who is relegated to the margins of Mitchell's book. Margaret Mitchell's estate took Alice Randall to court in an attempt to block the publication of The Wind Done Gone, claiming copyright infringement. But a U.S. Court of Appeals in Atlanta recently overturned a federal district judge's injunction and cleared the way for the book to go forward. The Wind Done Gone does for Margaret Mitchell's book what Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States did for American history books. It inverts our perspective and asks us to reimagine things from the point of view of those who never got to tell their own story in Gone with the Wind. But we'll let Alice Randall take it from there. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Amy, welcome. I'm glad to be with you.
It's great to have you with us from Nashville, Tennessee. Tell us the story of Sanara.
Well, first I've got to set a couple of things straight. It is no kind of sequel to Gone with the Wind. A sequel from a slave's point of view perhaps could be written, and I've said this before, you might call that thing Uncle Tom Goes to Tara. But I didn't write that, and I take strong issue with the idea of sequel. I have my degree in English from Harvard. Genre means a lot to me. It is not in any sense a sequel to Gone with the Wind. Two, you've said that Gone with the Wind has informed our view of the Civil War. I think it's really important for your listeners to understand, at least from my point of view, my book is not about the Civil War, and it's not about Miss Mitchell's view of the Civil War. The subject of my parody is Gone with the Wind. The subject of my criticism is Gone with the Wind. And it is, I think Gone with the Wind is as much about 1930, the time in which it was written, as 1830. I think Gone with the Wind is a work of political propaganda that is really there to support the ideology, to provide an ideology in support of Jim Crow segregation. And it argues two things principally to do that. One, the idea that blacks are intellectually inferior. Miss Mitchell is the major proponent in this century in letters of the ideology of black intellectual inferiority. Two, she introduces the idea of the incompetent black politician, the incompetent black congressman. She also, one of the most famous lines in Gone with the Wind is, "I don't know nothing about birth and no babies, Miss Scarlett." That was overheard in Nashville the same day that Buchanan chose his vice presidential candidate, a black woman, already turned into the joke, "Lossy, Mr. Buchanan, I don't know nothing about being no vice president," implying she had asserted competence where she had none. So I just want to be very clear that my book is an extremely political book that is responding what I perceive as political speech on Miss Mitchell's part. It is in no way in the realm to start talking about our character having set it up that way. It is not a novel about, it's a novel about the process of reading Gone with the Wind, and I'm not asking people as much to examine the South or the Civil War as to examine their own prior reading of Gone with the Wind, their own call to conscience, and that specific text. So I just had to get that on the table because so many people are misstructuring what it is I've done without having read the book, including a lot of serious journalists.
Can you tell us the impact that Gone with the Wind had when you first read it, Alice Randall?
I was shocked. I was living in Washington, D.C., and I did not know that there were people who perceived the Klan as being a positive political organization until I read Gone with the Wind. people who are only familiar with the film, and my subject is the book, the Klan was removed from the film. But the Klan is very, very active in the novel Gone with the Wind. And there's a wonderfully horrible scene in which Miss Pittypat, a cousin of an aunt of Scarlett, says, "Oh, surely, my dear, you must have a Klan in your neighborhood. They just killed a black man for acting uppity in mine." Literally, the Gone with the Wind argues that murder of blacks is appropriate, not in response to rape, not in response to some of the things we often hear that people of that period thought it was appropriate in response to, but merely for a black man acting in the fashion that some white person thought was arrogant. I considered that to be astounding, even as a 13-year-old. I was absolutely shocked by that. I was shocked by the constant portrayals of blacks as animal-like. They'd refer to mammy's elephant eyes. Of course, I did pick up on there is a sweet, sweet love story that is sugarcoating that poisonous politics. So I did have, you know, I admit in 12 or 13, there was a slight interest in the sugary love story, but I was literally shocked. I was confused. I had no idea there were any intelligent people, people capable of writing a book, who thought that the Klan were positive, was a positive organization when I read.
Now, D.W. Griffith's film, Birth of a Nation, which came out in 1916 and is set during the Reconstruction, was wildly popular then. It's now rightly seen by most as perhaps the most racist film of all time, sparked the rebirth of the KKK. Why do you think Gone with the Wind continues to be so popular when it traffics in some of the same stereotypes?
That's a great question, and that is exactly a question I want to ask America in the form of my book in some sense. Because you know, I started film, you know, you didn't even see, they didn't even show us Birth of the Nation at Harvard when we were studying film. They showed us some other of his works because it was so controversial at the time. Now, I'm not in favor of that. I believe in free speech. I believe in knowing your enemy, the more dialogue possible. But it is interesting that, and I think it's some sort of weird, I have no idea what the answer to that is. I want people to question that, ask that question themselves as they read my book and they wonder and they examine in their own conscience, their own mind, how did it work? When you ask people, do you remember the Klan and Gone with the Wind? Many people will say no, though in fact Scarlett's second husband is killed out on a Klan raid. That is how he gets killed. Cleaning out the darkies in a certain town. He gets killed on a raid in which he has participated in a mass murder. Did you remember that from the book?
I didn't.
See, it's interesting, but it's a major, it goes on for pages and pages in the book. It's not a small element. So I, you know, I am curious as to what is going on with the American consciousness that people don't know that. And I put a relationship, the book I think Gone with the Wind is related to is the bell curve. And the issue and the myth of black intellectual inferiority haunts us to this day. It haunts us in many ways, but one of the ways it haunts us that is, I think, most subtle that my book, I think, dresses most directly is the nature of text that African Americans have to read. What motivation does one have to approach reading when the texts that you are reading are so poisonous? Now, I also, many people have said, you know, 1936 were these not common views, but you know who was also writing in 1936 was William Faulkner, with a lot of the same background that Miss Mitchell had. But his black characters, even his domestic servant black characters, are not unintelligent. They are some of his most intelligent characters, though they all lack formal education. His South is not a South without mulattoes and these complex tragedies. So that is just a sort of touchstone to recognize that we have D.W. Griffith on one hand, but we have William Faulkner on another, that there are many Southerners who have written with insight and truth, more truth about that period, and we really should examine this text. Now, ultimately, I give her great credit because I think she was about a political ideology. I think she was about providing a propaganda to support Jim Crow segregation that was beginning to be under attack in 1930. She gave you a reason why blacks could not be in school with whites.
We're talking to Alice Randall. The Wind Done Gone is her book, the unauthorized parody. Can you tell us who Sonara is?
Sonara is the most absurd woman that could possibly arise out of the world of Gone with the Wind. The nature of parody has to do with, among many other things, with exaggeration and absurdity. And what is the most absurd character to possibly be inserted into the world of Gone with the Wind? An intelligent black woman. And then when you add that, a self-educated, intelligent black woman, you definitely have the most absurd character. So Cinerara is a woman, the daughter of, now, you have said these characters are not, Scarlet and Other are not the same character. Scarlet, Other is a parody of Scarlet. It is Scarlet meaningfully transformed. To give an example of how this transformations work, Melanie in Gone with the Wind is sweet, sweet, sweet character. She is the epitome of the Southern lady. In my book, her name is Mealy Mouth. Her identity is completely different. She's a multiple murderer. She is a sadistic multiple murderer. And the question I'm raising with that is, how sweet, sweet can you be if you are profiting, if every roof above your head, every floor beneath your feet, every dress you are wearing is provided by someone else's slavery death? So these are not, it's not, you know, Cinera, and you also mentioned in your introduction that Cinera was on the side of the first book. My main character does not exist in any form in Gone with the Wind. She could not exist in the world of Gone with the Wind and does not. The New York Times had that same misrepresentation, which is why I'm beginning to be annoyed by it. The myth of black intellectual inferiority reigns in so many different places. But Cinera is a character who begins her life as a slave on cotton farm, who is sold into slavery to a man, a Southern aristocrat, R, who becomes first his mistress, then his wife, in the process of which she begins to learn to read and write herself and to keep a diary. She is a woman who very much reads and writes herself way into being. And then she eventually leaves that R character for a black congressman. But since your listeners are more intellectual than most, after she's able to extricate herself out of a original Oedipal triangle in which she is vying with Other for Mammy's attention and perceiving her white biological father as the most powerful man in her world, once she comes to an understanding that her white father was not as powerful as she perceived, that he was being controlled by his black valet, and once she begins to have some sort of distance from this Oedipal struggle she has with Other for Mammy, mother's affection, she's able to make a free choice. And so, you know, this is not in the world of typical plot. This is in the world of taking one mythology and confronting another. And Cinera is a character who is able to finally transcend her childhood damage by getting some sort of distance on it, largely through reading and writing and making an independent choice. But it's not. Yeah.
Alice Rando, can you tell us the response of the Margaret Mitchell estate to the book, why they tried to prevent your book, The Wind Undone, from being published?
You know, it's hard for me to know anyone else's motivations, and I don't know what their motivations are. I have a respect for people who are older. They are deeply older than I am. They come from another time and circumstance. One of them said in an interview that they had not really read my book. But I really have no idea what their exact motivations are. I know what mine are, but I don't know what theirs are. Mine have to do everything with the world of poetry and politics. That's what my motivations have to do with. This is a book that has haunted me all of my life. I wrote it. My own mother, I grew up in Washington, D.C., went to Georgetown Day School. My own mother was dying as I finished this book. She had worked as a policy analyst in Washington, D.C. She was half black, half white herself. She's a person who I think had internalized specifically Gone with the Wind. As I said, I remember I read the book, then she took me to see it at the movies with a white friend of mine. And I remember here I'm sitting in this theater around 1969 with a white friend, and Hattie McDaniel and Butterfly McQueen come on the screen. And I'm being asked, and that's similar to what happened when I'm reading the book, the text before, that I'm being asked to disassociate myself from those characters and to laugh at them with my white friend and to feel that they are ugly. So many people, they look at Mammy and they say, she's asexual, most unattractive woman in the world. Something, I wouldn't do that even at that point. I refused to betray that image. I refuse to side with America laughing at Mammy and to try to look at that character in a different way. And that's interesting. I mean, that's sort of where the impulse for doing this lies. I think there are people who think, you know, who those images did not trouble in the same way.
We only have a minute to go, but I wanted to ask you, Alice Randall, the response you've received from women, from black women, white women, southern women.
I have had an extraordinary response from southern women. I had a wonderful woman who grew up in, wrote me a letter. She grew up in a county with no blacks. She said, told me she learned the word nigger hearing people say in Forsyth County, Georgia, that the sun, if the sun sets on a nigger here, it'll be a dead nigger. They should, she wrote me this. She said, what was I to do with this? And she said that she's 49 years old, and now she has two black friends, and she cannot even tell them about her childhood, although she also described her childhood as being in a wonderful place where she learned many great values. She said, what was I to do with this? And I have read your book. And she literally, I think, used the word redeemed. So we have had an overwhelming response. I've had black women. I had a black woman of almost 90 years old come to a reading and say, I've waited all, 50-some years to read this book. You read the same book I did, meaning my take on Gone with the Wind was similar to hers. And one of the new informations that this book, The Wind Done Gone, my critical parody of Gone with the Wind, provides is knowledge of how black people have read this book. I'd like to end by noting that Malcolm X had a whole paragraph about Gone with the Wind. It was a movie in his autobiography. Malcolm said seeing Gone with the Wind ruined an entire summer for him. And this is when he was a child. And I've tried to point out a text that could shame Malcolm. He said it shamed him. What could it do to a lesser person? And the idea that Malcolm was thinking about that time, how many years later when he was writing his autobiography and sharing this, this idea that blacks have been injured by Gone with the Wind is not new in our souls. It's just new in our literature that it is being acknowledged. This is not a rip-off idea. This is something that black people have privately talked about for decades. But as far as I know, only Malcolm did one paragraph on it, and I have decided to share that information with a larger group of people, some of whom seem to not want to hear it still. But this is part of our culture.
Well, Alice Randall, I want to thank you very much for being with us, joining us from Nashville, Tennessee.
Amy, and thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. The book is called The Wind Done Gone, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. And that does it for today's program. Quick fact, this weekend, Errol Maitland, who's our technical director, was finishing up his broadcast of WBIX.org at the International Arts Festival in Brooklyn. He and his family went home. His son, his nephew, went to walk a family friend home, and he was followed by police. They then got out of the car, and he says they started to choke him. There's going to be a press conference today at the law offices of Stacey Gray at 30 Vesey Street, and we'll be headed over there, and we'll let you know more about this story. That does it for the show from the Embattled Studios of WBAI. Thanks for listening.